No, it's absolutely a pleasure to be at Jamia again. I was here last March and did a reading from my latest book, Difficult Pleasures. But that was a much smaller audience, so I'm really happy to see the room filled up. And Asad did a very glowing introduction, so I hope I'm able to live up to it. What I thought I would do is take you through all my books. And I'm fortunate to not have written 19 books, so it should be a little easier. You know, talking about what you've written, talking about what you do as a writer is not always the easiest thing, and it can be a very fraught thing also, because there's not only one story to tell about what a writer is doing. There are many possible stories, as you know, as students of literature, there's so many ways of creating a narrative out of what a writer is doing. And the writer's own story is not necessarily the most interesting or even the most legitimate. But as writers, we're increasingly called upon to talk about our work. And the one question I am asked specifically quite often is, how do you move between these different genres? Because I've written poetry, I've written longer fiction, I've written short fiction, I do some amount of criticism. So the question I'm often asked, which at one level is a valid question, but it's also the easiest question to ask. Why do you work in so many genres? How do you move between these genres? And what I'd like to do is sort of try and graph a kind of continuity of interest, of theme, in my work, where the genre is important, yes, but despite the genre or along with the difference in genre, there's also been... There's also been some kind of thread, some kind of continuity. And at the risk of boring all of you immensely, I'm going to start by talking about the subject of boredom. A lot of my writing is actually connected to my own biography, not in the sense that I've directly told the story of my life in my work, but in the sense that my own situation, starting out in a relatively small town, has been sort of the basis for my earlier writing. And I started out writing poetry. Now, Shillong is not a tiny place. It is a relatively small place by Indian standards, but it is a capital city. It has people from all over the country living there. But growing up there in the 80s and the 90s, one very strong defining sort of emotion of growing up in a place like that was the feeling of boredom, was the feeling of being cut off from the world. Why I mention the 80s and 90s is because I don't know if the same is true today. Because in a very short space of time, our cities and the experience of living in our cities has changed a lot. And when I say cities, I mean even the smaller cities, because of a whole lot of reasons, which I won't go into now, but which we all know, because we all live in this so-called globalized world, which has changed our experience of even living in a small place. But for me, a sort of very emblematic, very defining experience, very defining feeling was this feeling of isolation or provinciality. And a few months ago, I was reading this wonderful book by the writer Orhan Pamuk, who all of you have probably read. And it's a book of essays about what it means to write fiction. And it's a very personal book. Most of the time, he's actually talking about his own reading as a young person living in Istanbul, right? And he says that one of the reasons why he was drawn to fiction so much is because he suspected that he was not at the center of things. Living in Istanbul and leading the kind of middle class life he did, he was cut off from the center. And he felt what he called Chekhovian provinciality. So this feeling of Chekhovian provinciality, you know, a lot of us would recognize that. And he read novels for two reasons. One, to escape that feeling. And the second, to actually reaffirm that, yes, indeed, life was elsewhere. Life was in the novels of Tolstoy, life was in the novels of Flaubert, or life was happening in these grand 19th century novels that his own life didn't have. So I think for me, that's a very evocative idea, that as a writer, the subject of your own life, the nature of your own life, is kind of ground for a feeling of boredom, a feeling of being cut off from the center. Now, there are two things I think that you can do faced with this feeling. One is that you can escape into fantasy. And the other is that you can turn the lens back on the boredom itself. Turn the gaze back on the boredom and see if it can become a creative source. And I think with my first book of, with my first and only book of poems, Street on the Hill, I was trying to do the latter. I was trying to see, is there something lyrical about this boredom? Is there something that can be turned into poetry about an ordinary middle-class existence in a small town, where you're not really important or part of the mainstream in any sense? And I'm going to start, therefore, by reading you a poem from this book. And it's an ode to the Chinese restaurant. So I'm taking this idea of the ode, which, as you know, the Romantics used to talk about, the classical ode to the Grecian urn, and so on, and see if you can use this idea of a lyrical poem, an ode poem in praise of something, to talk about something completely banal. But even though it's banal, at the same time, I'm talking about this idea of a Chinese restaurant as something, as a source of excitement. And again, that has changed because today, eating out, restaurants, and particularly the Chinese restaurant is very ubiquitous. You know, you could get Chinese food everywhere. But when we were growing up in Shillong, the idea of going out to eat was very exciting. And so I also see this poem in a way as a kind of record of a vanished kind of time, a vanished way of relating to the world. So I'll start by reading this poem. It's dedicated to my sister Daisy, with whom I wasted a lot of time sitting in Chinese restaurants. We come in here from the long afternoon stretched over the town's sloping roofs. Its greasy garages and ice cream parlors. Its melancholic second-hand bookshops with their many missing pages. Life's not moving. We sit at a red table among the dragons, near the curtained-off street-facing windows with their months-old orangeade. Out in the streets there are schoolboys with their ties askew and the garish fruit sellers. We eat more than we need to. We eat so that our boredom's no longer dangerous, so that from the comfort of soup, with the minor pleasures of chop suey, we can fend off the memory of cities unvisited, unknown and unknowable affairs, people with never fading lipstick and confident gestures who we will never be. One day soon, we'll be running. Our lives will be like the blur seen from a bus, and we won't read each other's letters thrice. But right there, we're young. We count our money carefully. We laugh so hard and drop our forks. We are plucked from sadness there, in that little plastic place with the lights turned low, the waiters stoned from doing nothing, the smells of ketchup and eternally frying onions. So that was a sort of a glimpse of how I try to make boredom lyrical. There's some chairs here if you want to come up in front. Do you want to come up here? My second book was a novel called Lunatic in My Head. This is how it looks, the new edition. Following this idea of boredom and how do you make it work in writing? In my second work, I sort of turned the attention not to my own boredom, but to the question of people in this town. And how do they deal with this idea of feeling cut off and feeling a sense of comfort, a sense of coziness in the small place, in the place that you've known all your life, but also a sense of frustration, a sense, again, of not being in the center of things. And I'm going to read a little bit from this book. There are three main characters, and I follow the trajectories of all three in parallel. And I think one thing that unites all the three characters is their complete fascination for Western culture. And now when I say Western culture, it's not, I don't mean in the sense of a sort of deliberate or self-conscious interest in the Western, but just a feeling of connection with, for instance, rock music, or having to teach English literature. And this is my second character, Firdaus Ansari, who teaches English literature and has a very ambiguous relationship to it, because she feels this is important, Shakespeare is important, Hemingway is important, and yet she feels very resentful of these figures, of these so-called important figures who she has to teach. So I'm exploring in this novel, I think I'm exploring different kinds of attitudes to this very, very, very dominating, very strong presence of Western culture in our lives. My younger character, Aman, is a big fan of Western rock music. So he listens to a lot of Pink Floyd, and now I'm branching into fantasy. So shall I close the door? Can you do that? It's just a little. Western culture, and I think wherever you grow up in India, wherever you have grown up, this is a sort of experience that will be recognizable to you. And like I said, at some point, I sort of. Do you want to come here? At some point, I sort of turned my attention to fantasy. And like I said earlier, fantasy is one of the ways in which you can deal with the feeling of being provincial, right? So now my character Aman, he writes lyrics, he writes poetry. And he imagines, because he loves Pink Floyd so much, he imagines that maybe he can make a connection to this band, to the singers of this band, by sending them his poetry, his lyrics. And for him, the ultimate excitement, the ultimate fulfillment would be if these band members actually take his songs, take his lines, and put them in their music. And of course, this fantasy has little relationship with reality, but it's a driving fantasy for this character. So I'm going to read you a bit where Aman is sort of keeps going out and looking, checking the letterbox, checking the postbox, to see if there's any post from the members of Pink Floyd. And the other thing that he's doing, and which he's not doing very well, which again I think is sort of emblematic of a lot of young people of a certain generation, is preparing for the civil services. Aman Mundi went out into the rain and peered into the letterbox by the door. Nothing except the electricity bill. He pulled it out, latched the box quickly, and dashed back into the house. His mother was watching television in the small dark room next to the sitting room, the colored images moving on the surface of her glasses, her eyes invisible behind them. She watched television serials wearing an expression of careful consideration, as if what the characters were saying held some personal significance for her. No one knew why she watched these serials. Long drawn-out dramas that ran into hundreds of episodes involving pliant daughters-in-law, wronged wives, scheming men, and bitchy women. They were remote from her world, and she was never heard to discuss them with anyone. Yet they occupied her intensely, and Aman would feel strangely relieved to see her before the television in the little room that even sunny days never brightened. Her absorption in the made-up lives of these overdressed men and women moderated some of the impatience that Aman inevitably felt towards his mother. She was diminutive and thin, with tired eyes behind large spectacle frames, her hair tightly drawn back from her face. Has the electricity bill come? Mrs. Mondi asked Aman as he passed by. Yes, said Aman. He said as little as possible to his mother. Pay it today, beta. It's come very late. They'll cut off the electricity if it's not paid on time. Obviously, thought Aman as he went into his bedroom and shut the door. Why do people spend so much of their adult lives worrying about the mundane and stating the obvious? He put the damp bill in his shirt pocket and pushed a cassette into the player. After some whispering and shuffling, a voice speaking in Hindi dramatically announced, "And now, from Gulshan Kumar's renowned and rainbow T-series, a garland of songs from the world's most wondrous band, Pink Floyd." The opening bass riff of Money confidently followed. Slowly drums and guitar joined in and a voice started singing. A minute into the song, a loud crash was heard, and a voice said incredulously, "Hell, this damn chair broke." Hysterical laughter, someone urgently saying, "Continue, continue." Another voice, possibly drunk, screeching, "Pink Floyd." Then silence. Aman rewound the tape and played it again. This was him and his friends from a few years ago at the house of a chap called Ibomcha, who had unreliable furniture. Some of them had just formed a band called the Proto Dreamers. They would play Pink Floyd covers at concerts and in private. When the tape played itself out, Aman replaced it with the real Dark Side of the Moon. He'd been listening to the album for the last 5 years, and its significance kept changing as his life changed. Once it was just good music. Everyone was into it. He'd heard it the way he would hear Led Zeppelin or Deep Purple. Now, Aman would consider such an attitude blasphemous. Floyd was to other bands what angels are to mortals. Possessed of the same features superficially, but actually inhabiting a different sphere altogether. So that's a glimpse of Aman, and that's how I introduce him to the readers. That's the very first section talking about Aman. So then you follow his adventures or his lack of adventures in Shillong, and what he does with his life over the 1 year or 1.5 years that the book is set. And I wrote this novel when I had actually left Shillong, and I think the fact of moving away enabled me to actually look at the lives of these characters as something that could be made into fiction. Whereas when I was in the city, like I've shown you with that poem, I was actually doing a little more autobiography, doing a little more of the reflective kind of writing about my own situation. With fiction, the one thing I learned, the one thing that is indispensable to writing fiction is irony. And what you need to do, what you need in order to be able to be ironic about your characters is distance. So for me, that move, that journey from the small town to the bigger city, and to be able to look back at the kind of life I had led and the characters I had known, enabled me to write what I think is a fairly ironic novel about life in Shillong. After a few years of writing Lunatic, I felt there was one character in it who had potential as a character in a future novel. And this is an 8-year-old girl called Sophie Das. And she, like the other characters, is also prone to fantasy. And her fantasy is that she is actually not a settler in Shillong. Her family hasn't settled there. All three of my characters belong to settler families. And it's very much... there are characters from all kinds of communities because Shillong is that kind of place. But the lens, the perspective, is largely from the point of view of characters, the kind of characters, the kind of families who've settled in this city. So Sophie's fantasy is that... You want to sit here? It's okay, it's fine. Sophie's fantasy is that she is actually not a settler, that she's a native. So it's the fantasy of being a native rather than an outsider, within quotes, right? So now, when I was planning the second novel, which is Neti Neti, The story was going to be the story of Sophie Das and her journey from being that 8-year-old girl who's in the grip of this fantasy to being an adult at loose, in a way, in the city of Bangalore. And Bangalore, to my character, to this character who's coming from a small town, is in some ways a very liberating city because she has more freedom, she lives on her own, she has a boyfriend, she works at a job that pays her very well, so she has her own money. So I wanted to explore these liberties for a young person in a big city. What kind of life do you lead? What's the nature of your existence if you live in this kind of milieu? But I also wanted to explore what are the things that you miss? And what are the things you find oppressive? And if you're in a crisis, where do you get your sense of strength from? Where do you get your sense of values from? If the older values have vanished? Because Sophie belongs to a world where the older things are a little more shaky, right? You don't have the same sense of religion or God. You don't look to your parents as a source of ethics or value or stability as maybe another generation did. You're more comfortable with your friends than you are with your family. So in such a situation, where does your sense of what is important or what is the distinction between right and wrong, where does that come from? And in Sophie's case, it comes from 3 books. She's only read 3 books in her life. And these are Flaubert's Madame Bovary, R.K. Narayan's Swami and Friends, and Swami Vivekananda, Awakener of Modern India. That is the sum of her reading. And that is the sum of her, what I would like to think of her as a spiritual resource. Those are spiritual resources. In a time of need, in a time of crisis, when she's unhappy, when things are going bad, those are the writers she remembers. And she has read these books so many times, she can actually remember whole passages from them. And this book was published in 2009. But a couple of months ago, a few months ago, I was reading an interview with the Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes. And he's a wonderfully imaginative writer, as you know. And Fuentes said a wonderful thing. He was asked about the condition of the writer in the third world, in third world societies. And he said that a lot of writers are like Don Quixote. We sort of try to live what we read, and we go and fall flat on our faces. And as you know, that's what happened to Don Quixote, right? He was reading these medieval romances, and he imagined that he's a knight and he's going to go out and save a damsel in distress. And of course, it's all in his head. It's all from the books he's read, all from these romances he's read. And reality doesn't quite keep up with Don Quixote's vision of the world. It's not quite like he imagines it is. So I thought that was a wonderful image, that this is how writers live as well. We imagine that the world is like the way it is in literature. And Fuentes says in this interview that a character like Madame Bovary is a daughter of Don Quixote. Now, why did he say this? He said this because, again, in Madame Bovary, you have a very romantic character. You have a character who's bored. She lives in a small town. And she has this very, very driving idea of romance, of a life that is more interesting than her current life. And where does she get that idea from? She gets it from books, right? She reads a lot of romances, she reads magazines, she reads accounts of the high life, the high society in Paris, and she starts dreaming that this could be her life, and what is preventing it? What is preventing this from being her life? And therefore she goes and has these completely disastrous affairs, and then we all know what happened to Madame Bovary at the end of that novel. So this idea of fantasy, this idea of romance, and literary romance, getting your idea of romance from books, to me that's a wonderful idea. And I think when I gave Sophie these 3 books as her guiding light, as her sort of lodestars, I was doing the same thing. I was saying, Sophie gets her ideas of romance. Sophie gets her ideas of what is important in life and where she should go from these 3 writers. So in a way, as Fuentes says, Flaubert's Madame Bovary is the daughter of Don Quixote. to me, my character Sophie Das is the daughter of Madame Bovary. And that's saying something about, it's saying something about literature, saying something about books, but it's also saying something about how we can pay tribute to older writers through our work. And Flaubert for me is a writer who, as he is for many realist writers, a kind of a very, very inspirational figure, because he's the first writer who actually tried to create a highly realist world in his fiction. So I'm both trying to pay tribute to Flaubert by having my character read Madame Bovary, and I'm also saying something about how we live through books, right? So I'm going to read you a little bit just to give you a flavor of the story. So now Sophie's reading, it sits oddly with her life in Bangalore, because her friends don't read. Her friends work in outsourcing, they work in... one of her friends is a recovery agent. He chases people who have defaulted on loans. So they work at very strange and very, very, in some ways, very new kind of work, which is only possible in sort of an India of the 21st century. But they get their excitements from elsewhere. They listen to rock music, they go for movies, but they don't read. And her boyfriend, Swami, she's very frustrated with him because he doesn't read either. And for her, her project, one of her projects in the novel, is to try and get him to read Swami and Friends. From which he of course, his name is Swami, but he hasn't read Swami and Friends. And I'm going to read a section not where Sophie is reading these books, but where she's reading something that actually everyone reads in the city. And what is that? That is newspaper supplement, page 3. Right? And she's trying to make sense of who are these people. And this is all still very new to her. She hasn't been in Bangalore long enough to actually treat this as completely normal and banal. So I'm going to read you a bit which gives you a sense of Sophie's state of mind. Sophie was a compulsive reader of these newspaper supplements and of glossy lifestyle magazines. She would read them furious at people who described their beach holidays, their self-designed bungalows, their favorite nightclubs. She ground her teeth, learning about wine appreciation evenings in swanky hotels, salsa competitions, champagne brunches, and tips on where to get the best lounge furniture. Massive idiots, she would say out loud, to those who considered going on cruise trips in the Mediterranean de rigueur, to those who were standing up in the restaurants and telling the chef he had made a mess of the osso buccio, to those who swore by their blanco shoes. As a result of her reading over the past year, neither seemed real to her. The city in which people, all of whom were about 33, zipped home from work and hit the party scene, and the city that Sophie saw when she walked in her own neighborhood. Here, the one or two tall, new, glassy stores that sold sports shoes or jeans or washing machines were still outnumbered by row upon row of small, one-room enterprises, all of them with grand names. The paper mart, piled high with bundles of old newspapers. The flour mill, where a certain number of floury people always sat waiting on folding chairs, calmly observing the street. The fragrant-smelling coffee works with its medieval-looking coffee grinder. The mishmash on offer in the novelty stores, the Iyengar bakeries, the chicken mutton stalls, the car and motorcycle wash, the horticultural cooperative societies and their occasionally fresh vegetables, the hole-in-the-wall ladies' tailors, the framing works whose framing work tended to take over the pavement, the juice stalls with their lineup of faded mixer grinders and their garlands of oranges and mosambis, the motor driving schools, the free reading room with its broken window panes, the remarkably high number of piles and fistula clinics, the hot chip shops where one man would be out on the pavement slicing potatoes into an enormous cauldron of boiling oil and the other inside mixing salt and chili powder into them, the many gold and silver jewelry stores, the shed-like restaurants with their zany hyphenated names, have more, sip and bite, hasty tasty, the Speak Good English coaching centers, the photo studios, the herbal beauty parlors, the shops with sad rows of old TV sets needing repair or burial. So that's just a glimpse of the way Sophie observes and the way she notices life on the street in Bangalore. One of the things about Neti Neti is that in some ways it's very much a novel about alienation and about actually feeling, and that's why it's called Neti Neti, which is like an Upanishadic mantra, which means not this, not this. And it's the mantra is used. The mantra is used when you're sort of in the process of searching for the divine, for Brahman. But your way of finding it is to say that it doesn't have any attributes. It's nameless. It's shapeless. It's formless. So you can never point to anything and say this is it. You always have to reach that center, that core, that Brahman, by saying this is not it. This is not it. And finally, when you've negated everything, you come to that one thing that is the divine. And I thought it's a beautiful idea to sort of transpose into a novel about contemporary urban city in India. Because for somebody who comes from the outside and is a young person searching for something and is a little more sensitive than her friends and her companions, she's everything that she does, every relationship, every job, every conversation, she feels this is not quite it. This is not quite what my life is meant to be. You know, so she's not a nihilist, but she is quite cynical and she is searching. And it like you probably guessed from that little section I read, it is very much a novel of the city and of describing what it actually tangibly, viscerally feels like to be in the city of Bangalore. And sort of progressing there from then, and also sort of like echoing or reflecting the way my own life has been since I moved to Bangalore almost 15 years ago. The book of stories that I wrote next, which was my fourth book, was sort of taking off from this idea of being in the city and leading a life that is in some ways alienated, in some ways holding a kind of vacuum at its core, but also the complete opposite of the boredom that I described when I was starting out. So whereas there you were rooted, you were cozy, you felt comfortable, and yet you had this fantasy or this dream that life was elsewhere, now you are in that elsewhere and you feel that, you know, this is not it. And so how do you deal with this paradox that you are in that place where you thought you wanted to be, but you're still not satisfied? You deal with it by constantly being on the move. So Difficult Pleasures, which is my latest book, which came out last year, is really very much about movement. And when I say movement, I mean both physical movement. A lot of the characters in these stories are actually traveling, and they're caught in that, you know, I capture them in that state of flux. Or mentally, spiritually, they are in a state of flux. So it's very much about going back to the places you knew, going to a new place for the first time, discovering something new within the place that you've always lived, things like that. So what I'm going to do now is read you a little bit from a story called The Big Picture. And I mean, my characters are from all walks of life. I have a story about a schoolboy in a village in Karnataka who plays truant and takes off for the big city. I have a lot of stories about young couples in the city and what are their lives like. But the one thing I keep coming back to is stories of artists. And when I say artists, it could be photographers, it could be writers, it could be painters. And I'm very interested in how they negotiate this state of flux, and they negotiate this big bad world of the Indian city. So the story I'm going to read is about a woman who is a painter, not in the professional sense, because she paints not to be a public figure, not to be successful, not to make money, not to travel, but to she paints for herself. She paints to kind of create a place for herself in the world. right? And what happens is there's a clash at some point in the story between this idea of yourself as an artist who paints or who creates for yourself and the expectation from the world around you that what you're creating is in a way public property, and you're obliged to sort of move into the public sphere, move into the public realm with this thing that you create for the public. And it takes, again, like I said, it takes a very tangible form in the story through the idea of travel. So Mrs. Ali, who does not like traveling and has never been abroad, in this story, she's on a plane for the first time. And the story is called The Big Picture. It is possible to feel completely at home in the world, but this is only because we have laid claim to a small space, a few rooms, certain streets, a familiar town, over which our habitual wanderings create grooves that we can comfortably slip into. In truth, the world is a strange and horrifying place, as Mrs. Ali discovered when she boarded a plane for Europe to participate in the opening of the exhibition in which her paintings were to feature. It started on the plane. On being asked if she wanted lime with her tea, she smiled and reached for a slice from the bowl that the steward held out. He jerked away as if bitten. Tongs please," he admonished, and Mrs. Ali dropped the slice back in shame and confusion. She worried about the incident while the other passengers fell asleep around her. Surely she was in some fundamental sense uncivilized if she could not make the connection between a pair of tongs and a slice of lemon.
No whisper in case.
She thought of her husband and wished he weren't dead, so she could blame him. As things stood, she only had herself to blame. She took silent revenge on the steward by imagining him ignorant of much about life too. The paintings of Pablo Picasso, for instance. I'm going to Europe to see the paintings of Pablo Picasso, she thought. The ring of that sentence comforted her, and she grew drowsy. The man next to her snored in exactly the blaring way Mr. Ali used to. Every time she drifted off to sleep, she woke up anxious from the dream that she had confused this man with her husband and leaned her lolling head on his shoulder. Mrs. Ali lived alone and occasionally went out to buy art supplies, shop for groceries, visit the doctor in connection with her various minor ailments, chat with her old classmate Sarah. Sarah traveled all over the world, but Mrs. Ali scoffed at the idea of going anywhere. But now, her own paintings had already reached Europe. She imagined them lying in their casing on the floor of the empty gallery. The thought that they had traveled so far amazed Mrs. Ali. After her children left home and Mr. Ali died, she tended to spend long hours just sitting at a desk in her study and looking out of the window. Slowly, unobtrusively, she set up canvases in the room, moved her collection of art books there, started playing with her brushes and paints. The memory of the art classes she had taken as a teenager, classes eventually abandoned because everyone painted better than her, did not embarrass her anymore. She painted the life that moved right under her nose. Women foraging for firewood in the overgrown empty lots between apartments. The names of to-be-married couples written with dyed wool on giant arches outside the wedding hall near her home. A park at closing time with the last child refusing to disembark from the last seesaw. A fruit seller sitting beside small hills of differently colored mangoes. Mrs. Ali had a fat stack of paintings that no one had seen when Frida came to visit. And Frida is a curator who will then compel Mrs. Ali to travel to Europe. And the story is about her misadventures during this journey. So that is the arc of my writing. And I've given you little glimpses from all my four books. And as you can see, it's both sort of, hopefully there's a consistency and there's a thread. But I've also been following certain ideas to do with boredom, to do with fantasy, to do with travel, to do with a contrast between life in the big city and the small city. And I've explored that through these four books. So, yeah, now it's open to questions. If you have any.